from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in July of 2014 in Albany when New York State lawmakers said yes to medical marijuana. The legislature passed the Compassionate Care Act, which would allow healthcare providers to recommend marijuana under carefully controlled circumstances. What kind of patients might receive a recommendation for medical marijuana? Cancer patients, MS, serious disabilities, patients perhaps with HIV/AIDS, that's for starters. Well, 2 weeks ago, the state's first dispensary opened, but the Rochester dispensary has not. The new law is rolling out this month, and there are still many questions about it. Which doctors are licensed to recommend medical marijuana in our region? How would a patient know where to go to get it? When will the local dispensary open? Will insurance ever cover it? And more. This hour, we're going to try to answer those questions, your questions if you have them, with our panel. Let me welcome my guests. Nancy Adams is here, the executive director of the Monroe County Medical Society. Nice to have you, Nancy. How are you?
Thank you. I'm well, thanks.
Dr. Bill Valenti is here, the co-founder and a staff physician at Trillium Health. Hello, Dr. Valenti.
Hello.
And Veronica Volk is alongside me, helping guide the ship this hour, WXXI reporter who has covered this issue rather extensively recently and certainly helped prepare this hour. So nice to have you here, Veronica.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, I want to just start with the fact that I don't know if we know which doctors can even recommend this. Veronica, we were talking last week in the newsroom and someone brought up the question, well, who's going to have, do you have to be licensed? Which doctors can do this? What are the questions there?
Sure. So I think a good place to start for this conversation is the reason that this Compassionate Care Act was passed is obviously because there's a lot of interest in using it as treatment for patients that need it. And the idea there would be that patients would have the power then to go out and seek out this kind of treatment. But what we know is that patients don't have access to information about what doctors are registered to recommend medical marijuana, and that could be a potential barrier to them getting it.
Okay, Nancy Adams, what questions on this side of the issue are there in your mind here?
Well, unfortunately, there's more questions than answers in my head right now. So in addition to getting the information about which physicians are certified to be able to recommend medical marijuana for their patients, our physicians are calling us with questions about dosage and drug interactions, and will this actually be effective? And what do we do about adverse reactions? Supposedly a lot of that information is covered in the continuing medical education course that the physician is required to take before making the recommendations. But frankly, I wish the Department of Health would remove some barriers about taking that course. For example, offer it free of charge to the physician so we can possibly generate more interest.
Okay. And when it comes to who is going to be prescribing it, well, let's not use that word. In fact, one of the first questions we had this hour came from a listener named Jake, who, let me read Jake's question in its exact language because I think it will be clarifying for us. Jake writes, can your guests briefly recap the exact criteria for prescriptions? And Veronica, I noticed that you have been careful not to use the word prescription.
Sure, we got to start with that word prescribe. So states all over the country are dealing with this, of course, because federally, marijuana is still considered a Substance A drug. And in order to kind of get around, there's this huge loophole where doctors can't actually write a prescription like you would think of. Instead, they have to recommend to their patient. Now, what happens is a doctor will sit in an office with their patient, and under the laws of free speech, they're allowed to discuss the possible benefits of medical marijuana. The patient can then leave the office and make an independent decision about whether or not they would be interested in this treatment. And then the doctor can help them sign up to get their medical marijuana card. It's called a recommendation, not a prescription in that way. And it frees the doctor up in case there's any sort of federal liability.
Is that about right in your mind, Nancy Adams?
Well, the one step I would add is the requirements for the physician. So that the physician has to take a required 4-hour CME course before they can even make that recommendation. Dr. Valenti, you may have some other comments.
Yeah, have you done that? I mean, because Bill, you're saying Trillium and you right. are not going to be recommending medical marijuana for your patients, correct?
Not at this point. We decided as an organization that we would take a different look at this and try and understand where cannabis fits along with other regulated drugs and other things that we're doing. So, in contrast to the University of Rochester and Rochester Regional Health, which appear not to have made the decision organizationally, we decided as an organization to take another look at this because we're dealing with cannabis in the context of a significant issue with prescription drugs and controlled drugs that are also a part of the picture for a lot of people. So we want to try. We want to, if we're going to do it, we want to do it right, which is going to take some time. The other thing for Trillium is we have a large HIV program with 800 patients, but HIV care has changed a lot in the past 20 years, so that the urgency for something like medical marijuana in HIV/AIDS is really very, very different because of the way treatment has evolved.
It's not as urgent.
It is not as urgent.
Okay, so if this were 10 years ago, do you suspect your position might be different on this?
Absolutely.
Yeah, interesting.
The appetite problems, weight loss problems, those kinds of things which were significant problems in people with HIV of 10 to 15, 20 years ago have really gone away for the most part. So the urgency in our HIV/AIDS patients is really much less.
Okay, but you still say you want to kind of take a look at it, take your time. Could your mind change over time with more information?
Sure, it could change over time. Because we think that, first of all, there may be a fit here for some of our patients. Need to understand it better. Nancy pointed out the issue of dosage, dosing, formulation. Is it are we talking about gels or pills, those kinds of things? What works best for which situation? It's a very steep learning curve, I think, for a physician. And, you know, in HIV, we've spent the past 30 years trying to be on the cutting edge of new treatments. So novel therapies are not new to HIV medicine. But this is different still.
Okay. Would the option to smoke it, which is not in play here, would that change it at all for you?
Actually not, because we're preaching on the one hand smoke cessation and good lung care and good overall health. So I'd have trouble encouraging people to take something that they needed to inhale like
okay.
That. I'm really okay with the gels and pill formulations that are a part of this. At the same time, I'd still like to understand better what the correct dosage and formulation should be for somebody with, say, neuropathy, nerve pain.
Sure, absolutely. And so, Veronica, Nancy, correct me if I'm wrong, as the 23rd state with medical marijuana,
right.
Something like that, I think most, if not all the others, do allow smoking in some form. I think we're one of the only, if not the only, that does not. Mm-hmm. And we talked to some doctors, I would have said, I think it probably was in the summer of 2014 when a lot of this debate was happening. Some doctors on this program indicated that there is definitely a difference in delivery system and expectation of impact of smoking marijuana versus the oils and gels, et cetera, that may end up rolling out. Now, we don't want to waste too much time on that because it's not part of the Compassionate Care Act. It's just
right.
Not part of it. But do you have any complaints that you're hearing among doctors?
No, in fact, most of the physicians I'm hearing from are, pleased that it's not available by smoking. Not only that, as Dr. Valenti said, it sends such a mixed message, but quite frankly, with the lack of experience with medical marijuana and given the fact that you want to have a measured dose, so, especially as we're starting out here and getting the experience, smoking it would be, just throw some more kind of unknowns into the situation, and just in terms of how much did the patient actually inhale,
Gotcha. Okay, so let's work through this for people who may think they want or need medical marijuana going forward, or if you know someone, maybe you have a child. All right, what's the process going to be? Because as we're establishing, we still don't really know which doctors are going to be able to recommend it. What do you do? What's the first thing that someone might want to think
about? Well,
I
guess the first thing that you would do as a patient who's exhibiting, symptoms or diseases that are eligible. And actually, Nancy, could you just, remind listeners maybe what the qualifying conditions are of the Compassionate Care?
Right. And that this is an important one. We're getting questions from patients, over at the medical site, and I think there is some confusion. So, as Evan mentioned in the beginning, cancer, HIV, AIDS, ALS, at Lou Gehrig's disease, Parkinson's disease, multiple sclerosis, spine cord injury, epilepsy, inflammatory bowel disease, neuropathy, and Huntington's disease. So it is a limited set. The Department of Health is considering expanding the condition criteria. I think they're in particular looking at Alzheimer's disease right now. But so as a patient, if you don't have one of those conditions, the conversation's not going to be going very far. So obviously, a next step, you're going to have that conversation with either your primary care physician or your specialist. And until the Department of Health actually release the list of physicians who have agreed to allow their name to be listed for physicians to view, right? So it's not necessarily even going to be the complete list. It's going to be very difficult to access medical marijuana in Rochester.
Should that change? Is that good enough for you? I mean, it seems like there's a little bit of a lack of transparency on how the system is even working there.
Well, my understanding is that actually it was Columbia Care that was making, they're the local medical marijuana dispensary and manufacturer in the area. They were pushing for a sort of database of doctors that would be recommending medical marijuana that were registered to do so. And this was a compromise on behalf of the New York State Department of Health. They're like, okay, we'll put together this database, but we only want doctors to have access to it because they're the ones who are really going to be needing this information. They can be the gatekeepers.
Okay, so you're going to have to ask. If you have a qualifying condition, you're going to have to ask, try to find out if there are doctors in our area who are on the list. You know, I was just reading in the Buffalo News, Amherst, there are a number of doctors who are, I guess, a little bit more publicly known and talking about it there, right?
I mean, if you're a doctor who is registered to recommend medical marijuana and you want to make that publicly available, I mean, there are ways that you can do that. If you're a patient, it can be a little bit more difficult.
But you shouldn't assume, even if you have a qualifying condition, and even if a doctor that you're in touch with can recommend it, it sounds to me like you shouldn't assume there will automatically be a recommendation. Just reading, for example, from the Buffalo News, the headline, Western New York Physicians Cautious About Rollout of Medical Marijuana Treatment, and talking to various doctors there, they're essentially saying, we're trying to respond to the needs of our patients, but we're going to be very conservative. We want to go by the book, but the thing is with medical marijuana, there is no book. So we're going to start slow and start low as we go, as we roll this out. That's from one of the doctors at the Dent Neurologic Institute in Amherst. So it sounds like we shouldn't just expect even a qualifying condition, you're going to get a recommendation.
That would be my take on this too, right? You know, at this point in time. And I'm actually very anxious to know when the Department of Health is going to start releasing names to physicians. And I do think this is going to be a process. I think for organizations like Trillium, who are being very thoughtful about this, we're going to get information, and you will very likely see, you know, more physicians embracing this. But it will be a slow go.
Bill?
Well, what's different about this is that marijuana has the history of being a recreational drug, and that it seems to me that the way the health department has structured this is they've done everything at multiple levels to reduce the chance of drug diversion, that is, taking medical drug and using it for recreational purposes. We have a lot of medical drugs that sometimes are used for recreational purposes. This is a recreational drug that's being converted to medical use, so it's a little bit different. And every time we see appears to be a block from the health department, for example, the list of doctors that can be viewed only by doctors, I'm not necessarily agreeing with that, but I'm trying to understand it. And the way what it appears to me is that they're saying to physicians, it's up to you to know who to refer the patient to and make that referral. The other is that because it's a recreational drug historically, the issue of doctor shopping and combining it with other drugs becomes an issue. So I'd say whatever we say about the New York State program, it's tightly regulated.
That's for sure.
Yeah, I think there's
it's the understatement.
Some agreement there. Before we get to, I have an email from Alex about cost and insurance. Before I even get there, as I mentioned at the start of the hour, the Rochester Dispensary, which is where, Veronica?
At Eastman. It's expected to be at Eastman Business Park. They haven't opened yet.
Not open yet. So the first dispensary in the state opened 2 weeks ago today. 20 dispensaries there will be across the state. I think a cluster of them around the New York City area for good reason, and then sort of pockmarked throughout the rest of the state. The Rochester one is not open. Do we know when it could be?
In the near future. The last I heard from them, it was going to be mid-January, but as we know, it's now heading towards late January. But we should expect it soon.
Are you hearing anything on that, Nancy Adams?
No, and I would expect the lack of physicians who are certified probably plays into that decision.
Okay, so... You know, we're not getting to the point where a January rollout, I don't think we can say they're way behind schedule. As we said, it's sort of a low and slow build. But even without a local dispensary, I guess you could talk about it. Maybe there's a dispensary in 100 miles or something. But until that's open, is it a non-starter, Nancy?
Well, sorry to interrupt. But what's really interesting about this is that there are 5 medical marijuana companies that are authorized to manufacture and dispense marijuana in the state of New York. And of those 5 companies, the dispensaries that you see open and serving patients, they're all downstate. So obviously I'm not going to speculate on whatever motivation there was to start, dispensaries in Union Square or down in that area. But you see definitely a divide.
Okay. I'm sure we'll cover it when the first one opens here, and that will sort of move that train along here. But Alex is now writing an email from a listener named Alex just asking about, is it insured? Is medical marijuana covered by insurance? And if it's not, what should we expect to pay? So the first answer is no, not covered by insurance. And Nancy Adams, not covered in New York State or really anywhere that I know of medical marijuana.
Yeah, I'm not aware of it being covered by health insurance.
Okay, so what should people expect to pay if they get a recommendation?
There are so many different reports on this, anywhere from $200 to $1,300 a month. We do know Columbia Care, that has the dispensary open in Union Square. They're selling eyedropper bottles with liquid or oils, and they're $100 to $300 a bottle.
And I guess part of it depends on how much of it you need,
That's
right?
The thing. You don't know anything about dosing. And a lot of this is really complicated for doctors because there's a lot of autonomy that's taken away from doctors in this process because of the several degrees of separation that you have to go through in order to prevent yourself from being liable for sort of like this federal drug offense.
And that liability issue is huge. In December, there was 100 years of case law that kind of went out the window with a suit that was brought in New York State by a patient who had a procedure done, was prescribed a narcotic, and then drove their car that day, got into a car accident. And now they're blaming the physician, saying that the physician didn't counsel them properly about not driving a motor vehicle. So there are a lot of concerns related to liability, and I think that's just an example of something that could happen. You know, physicians have to remember to document everything that they discuss with patients, you know, in such a way that it'll stand up in a court of law.
So you think some will be gun shy?
Yes.
Bill?
Correct. The liability issues have not been well characterized, but if you look at the framework around currently regulated drugs, the opiate drugs, benzos, those kinds of agents, there's now a database that we need to use to access to make sure the patient doesn't have multiple prescriptions of the same drug from different physicians, trying to avoid abuse and over prescribing. And our prescribing habits are monitored by the health department and other authorities so that overuse of drugs, of regulated drugs, is a problem, triggers an audit, licensing, and other kinds of reviews that I think all of us really want to avoid at all costs. Now, we're talking about something brand new here, so my question again is, how does it fit with what we know already
is in existence.
Sure. And, you know, I don't want to get too sidetracked here, but I do think this is an interesting part of the conversation, concern about lawsuit, which is not new in medicine. Okay. But and maybe producer Megan Mack can help me and look it up here. I just read an article recently in The New Yorker about a doctor who prescribed a controversial and sort of unlicensed treatment for a brain tumor just a couple of issues ago. And the article focused on the fact that this Dutch doctor who has done wonderful work in dealing with brain tumors over the years also saw there were certain tumors that progressed very quickly and the prognosis was very bad. And there wasn't a whole lot of things that worked. And there were certain sort of low sample size observations. And I don't want to get into it because some of it is pretty macabre stuff. But I will just say he was willing to tell patients privately, look, this is not licensed. This is not approved. But do you want me to try this? And he did it with three separate patients. The hospital that he worked at found out about the first one, and they said, okay, that's not going to be considered research. It's going to be a different category. We'll kind of allow it, but let's not make it a habit. He did two more. He got in trouble, lost his job. Now he's working in Huntington, West Virginia. But he argues, if I can explain to a patient that this isn't approved or I don't have a thumbs up from the FDA yet, or this could take 9 years to get approval, but you're going to die or you're going to be dealing with this condition and it may work and it may make things worse and you can sign off on that. Why shouldn't we allow it? And when you talk about concern about lawsuits with medical marijuana, if I came to you, Dr. Valenti, or somebody in the medical field, and I said, I've got constant pain or seizures or MS, these issues, and Bill said, I don't know that this is going to work. But I want you to have the option, and I want you to know that it might, and I want you to know that it might not, and I want you to know that it might also have side effects that we don't even know about yet. Are you willing to take that risk? If I put my name on the paper, shouldn't that be enough to inoculate Bill from getting sued, Nancy?
You know what? The Salino and Barnes of the world have field days with it. I didn't know you meant that, doctor. Oh, so it could get worse, right. But I didn't think that would happen. So it's a very tough situation. And remember that many of the patients that will be appropriate for medical marijuana are children with seizure disorders, yeah. For example. So yeah. Now you have someone else making a decision for another person. This gets very complex.
Bill, what do you think?
The monitoring follow-up of patients is absolutely critical here. And one of the pieces of the legislation talks about the relationship between the physician and the patient. In other words, the patient needs to be have a connection to that physician. It's not a one-and-done where you see the doc and prescription is written or a recommendation is given. But instead, it requires an ongoing relationship. So there's that piece. The other thing about prescribing unlicensed treatments in the early days of HIV, that's all we had and got through it.
Was there a risk of getting sued in those days?
There was a risk. There was a risk, but I'll tell you, it never happened.
It never. You never saw a lawsuit?
Never.
Did you fear it?
I'll tell you what was the bigger driver of that was the desperation.
Yeah.
Living in a MASH unit, like having that MASH unit mentality,
yeah.
Of the early days where the patient was going to die. And do you want to try this? And we'll do it. And we did it. But it's it was a different era, a different disease, different outcome. The practice of medicine today is regulated and structured in a different way so that I'm not sure if there were another HIV epidemic or something like that, how it would play out, because it was a different era.
Hmm. Okay. Well, I am heartened to hear that you were never sued.
Never.
Yeah. And so, anyway, the bottom line is the piece I was referencing was from the December 7th issue in The New Yorker. It's called Bacteria on the Brain, if you want to reach it. Very interesting there. Let's finish Alex's question on cost and insurance then, because it is not insured. But the question then becomes, could that change over time? We're going to start to see, with more states doing it, better chance to get a look at results. Bill just said, we've got to monitor patients going forward, you know, whether it's MS, HIV, you know, chronic pain, other things. Nancy, do you foresee insurance stepping in at any time, and how much evidence are we going to need before they'll do that?
Yeah, I, you know, there are some insurance companies with, even with new medications that are more traditional have a six-month waiting period. So I can't imagine with something like this that we would see anything, you know, before the first year of experience and data.
Okay. Well, I'd like to, if we could, Veronica, I know you've got some sound that we can listen to from Nick Vita. Can you tell us about
that?
Sure.
Before we get there real quick, though, Evan, I just wanted to talk to you about there's another company called Vireo Health. They're another licensed medical marijuana distributor in the state. And they have low-cost options for low-income patients. So there's also the potential for the company to, you know, go out of their way to maybe make this treatment available, especially if they're motivated to do so for research purposes. But to set up this cut, like we were talking about, Nick Vita, he's the president and the CEO of Columbia Care, which I said is the local dispensary. And they have facilities all across the country. So they treat a lot of different patients, and they've been treating patients with HIV and AIDS. And basically, you know, what he's saying here is that if they get to a point where they have the research about the dosing and they have the research about the side effects, then maybe that's something that would be very attractive.
What we've discovered is that about 65 to 70% of our patients that used to use opiates no longer use opiates and now use medical marijuana, which has a lower side effect profile. You don't have nearly the same, you know, addiction issues, and their outcomes are actually better. So if there was a way for us to statistically prove that we could manufacture a consistent product that could be dosed in a particular way, that could improve the outcome and the quality of life of a patient, while at the same time potentially saving money because it's a naturally grown product, it's organic, I think that would be really attractive to an insurance company.
Now, obviously, he has a little bit of an agenda, but
I think.
but, you know, I do think it's worth mentioning that companies are going to be working with local universities and local medical health providers in order to get this research done, in order to, you know, get some of that statistical proof that they need.
Yeah. Okay. Nancy, what do you think of that?
Well, I think I have some real concerns about the statement that he made just in making the presumption that there will be fewer side effects with medical marijuana. We don't know that yet. So that's, to me, is just kind of a red flag. But we may get there.
Okay. It's anecdotal, basically, is what speaks to the major problem.
Dr. Valenti?
Yeah, speaks to the need for studies, research, to try and understand which of the cannabinoid chemicals works for which situation. Right now, the data are pretty skimpy in terms of actual benefit shown in a clinical trial. Spasticity from multiple sclerosis, the nerve pain or neuropathy pain, and an appetite stimulant in some situations. So we do need more information. In the meantime, just a quick return to my earlier comment about never having any litigation as a result of using unapproved therapies. The other difference there was that we followed our patients very, very closely. Some patients we saw twice a week. And the other thing that we had was a very trusting doctor-patient relationship. Mm-hmm. Speaks to the closeness of the follow-up and the need to be engaged with the patient. So if you can do that around something like this, you can manage the risk to the physician. But it requires some doing in terms of that doctor-patient relationship.
I'm not surprised to hear you say it, Bill, just because knowing people who've gone to Trillium, gone to need you and the staff services over the years, it is a bit of a different feeling. It's more intimate. It's in many ways, I think, in recent decades. And now we know much more about it. It's more, for lack of a better word, mainstream. But are you concerned that that relationship between doctors and patients across the industry doesn't exist as closely as what you're describing?
Well, it's sometimes harder to maintain because of a variety of regulations and how about distractions?
You from mean lack of FaceTime with patients?
Exactly, because I spend a lot of FaceTime in front of a computer screen trying to navigate an electronic health record as opposed to actually face-to-face with the patient.
Sure. And the other thing is many patients seeking episodic care through urgent care centers, which have, have their purpose, absolutely. But sometimes there isn't that longitudinal relationship.
All right. If you want to call the program, we're trying to answer your questions about the rollout of medical marijuana in New York State. It's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994 if you're right here in Rochester. I've got a pile of your questions and comments as well via email and Twitter. Going to get to that in a moment. Let's get a very short break, and we're going to come back with our guests for the hour. Nancy Adams, the Executive Director of the Monroe County Medical Society, Dr. William Valenti, co-founder and staff physician at Trillium Health, and WXXI reporter Veronica Volk, helping guide the hour for us after the excellent reporting she's been doing on this subject in recent weeks as well. So short break and your questions next. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on the next Connections. First hour, it's our next edition of Unleashed the Pet Show. We'll be answering your questions about your animals at home and have some stories from the animal world as well. Then second hour, we're talking about the Democrat and Chronicle's Unite Rochester Challenge. 89 offerings for your support. We'll talk about the ideas to make our community stronger. That's Friday.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Renova Solar, serving upstate New York with the design and installation of solar power systems for home and business. More information at renovasolar.com.
Let's get to our first phone call. Jane in Rochester, first up. Go ahead, Jane.
I wonder sometimes if we don't go too far in the other direction of being so cautious with our drugs. And I realize the medical establishment is committed to doing no harm. So when there's a doubt, you would probably be very, you know, err on the side of withholding drugs. But I've seen people very elderly, very sick, very much in pain, who would have been willing to risk dire side effects and so forth for a little relief from their disease. And I want to tack on to that. I want to get your opinion on that. Have we gone too far in the other direction? I got a morphine pump once when I was in the hospital. I didn't ask for it. It didn't do any good either because it just kept me asleep. But what I want to ask you is glaucoma must be on that list, and what would medical marijuana do for that, but would you respond to that we need to be a little bit more flexible in some cases and let people just live with the risk if that's their choice? Thank you, Jane.
Let's start there. We'll work I think we kind of just covered that in the discussion about therapies.
That longitudinal relationship and close follow-up, the relationship between the doctor and the patient, is a great equalizer in situations like this.
And she asked about glaucoma. You guys know? I don't know. Is that not on the list?
Not on the list.
But anecdotally, at least historically, people have talked about the benefits of cannabis for glaucoma, but it didn't make the list. And I think the data are probably soft based on an article from the American Medical Association recently where they sort of went through what is known and what isn't, and glaucoma did not make the list.
So. Okay, doesn't mean it won't help. It means right now the evidence isn't there enough to put it on the list. So perhaps, Jane, that could change, but not on the current list in New York State. Peggy in Palmyra, next up. Go ahead, Peggy.
Hello?
Hi, Peggy. Go ahead.
Hi. I was just an off-the-wall question. If medical marijuana is legal and they established a grow house or so many grow houses in New York, and the doctors don't want to prescribe it and the patient can't make the case that they need it, what do they do with all of the weed that they grow?
Good question, Peggy. Thank you.
That is a great question. Actually, I asked Nick Vita that last time I had the chance to interview him, you know, if this were not that specific question, but along the same line, if this weren't to take off, you know, what would they end up doing? They're promising to create a lot of jobs in the area, which was a big push for them. And what if they fall flat on their face? And he basically said, we're not looking that far ahead right now. We're hoping for the best and we're preparing to, you know, deliver as much as we can to the community. So I don't think they have a backup plan.
But I think that you raise a very good point. Some of the information from the Department of Health actually does address safe disposal issues. So there's one situation where we've grown it all, no one's using it, which I think is probably highly unlikely. You know, I think things will evolve. But we also have the situation where it has been recommended for a patient and it doesn't work. So now they have, you know, you get a 30-day supply and you've got, 15 days left. Patients really need to be educated about how to dispose of the medical marijuana safely.
And from what I'm reading, and Veronica, help me if I'm wrong on this, but this is where, again, medical marijuana is not going to be a traditional kind of drug because, as we said earlier, you're not getting a prescription. You're getting a recommendation from a doctor, which is not the same. And then, once our local dispensary opens, patients have to rely on the staff there to tell them how to use it as opposed to, since doctors technically can't, is that?
Exactly, yeah. So you are going to be reliant on the people who work in the dispensary to talk to you about how to dose it and all that other information that comes with prescribing a drug.
So you're not following up with a doctor, you know, am I using it right? What am I seeing so far? I mean, you're not getting much back from...
From where I'm sitting, there's a lot of nuance here, but from what I've from speaking to doctors who are registered, you're not supposed to give that kind of guidance, and patients will be reliant on the dispensary.
Is that right, Nancy?
Well, ultimately, the patient is going to call the physician when there's a problem. So that is why.
And that's okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, of course. Yes.
Well, I mean, I say that's okay. Then the physician will.
Yeah. I don't know that the physicians are banned from having these conversations with their patient at all. But the responsible person is the pharmacist at the dispensary.
Okay.
And again, you know, the physician has to be informed enough to be able to answer and understand the questions and the situations, that the patient is experiencing.
I'm sensing, though, in reading about, the Buffalo News story, listening to what Nancy's telling us, listening to Veronica's reporting in recent weeks, that you're not going to have any doctors telling a patient this is a panacea. That's not going to happen. And I think that there's going to be a lot of honesty about what we know and what we don't know. Don't you suspect?
I would absolutely agree. And that's where this incremental, let's get some experience, that'll build the knowledge base so that we can make better decisions about which patients will benefit from medical marijuana.
Bill, would you feel like if you decided, and again, Trillium is not going to go forward with recommending medical marijuana at this point right now, but if you did, would you feel like you had a lot to learn? I mean, would you, before you could answer patient questions about...
Yes, a steep learning curve. Now, we have some experience with adjusting doses and managing medication and sometimes doing it on the fly. That's why we call it the art of medicine in addition to the science. But it takes a little bit of experience because this is a new preparation, new delivery system, and not something we've done before. So absolutely a steep learning curve. So I'm okay with where we are in terms of pacing ourselves.
Okay. I want to get to Joe and Dave's comments on Twitter. Joe has 2 points. First of all, he says the first thing he thinks needs to be done is to remove marijuana from Schedule 1. Veronica brought that up earlier. Just a quick recap. It's a Schedule 1 drug.
Yeah. Federally illegal.
Federally illegal. Is there any movement to that you're aware of, Nancy, to remove it from Schedule 1?
Yeah,
Bill?
There's... I mean, no, oh, to remove it... Yeah, actually, there are... there are some activities in that area. I don't think they've got a lot of traction right now.
Okay. Same, Dr. Galanti?
Correct. And because of that, that adds another layer of caution. It seems to me that the legislation accommodates that so far. Time will tell.
Okay. Joe follows up to say, to my knowledge, there are strains of medical marijuana that won't get you high or as high. Charlotte's Web comes to mind. I remember reading about this maybe a year or two ago. And Veronica, I don't know if you've reported specifically on strains.
So, no, I haven't. But Charlotte's Web, if I'm not mistaken, was a strain of cannabis that was used to treat a young girl with epilepsy.
Correct.
Am I correct? Yeah. And it was highly effective. Again, this was one case study. But she was suffering, I think, multiple seizures a day, and she went down to one or to a year, possibly.
Well, there are many different chemicals that are categorized as cannabinoids. And apparently the Charlotte's Web cannabinoid is specific, more specific and more beneficial in this for seizures. But there are many, we're talking about many different chemicals and chemical preparations. Another part of the learning curve.
Right, and that's why when we speak monolithically about medical marijuana, we have to be careful with that. And that's why I wish we had a grower sitting here to kind of...
Right, and I'm totally in really deep water here, but I'm going to say that marijuana has to do with the plant, and cannabis is the actual medical product that people will be using, liquids and oils. And the ratio of cannabinoids to THC, which is the chemical that gets people high, which is what makes people so afraid of it, is different in medical cannabis in order to bring out the good effects without... I guess, making you high.
And I suspect, again, deep water myself here, not being a grower, but I suspect growers would probably tell us that as we go over time here, in 1 year, in 5 years, in 10 years, they'll probably have a better sense for which strains are doing different things. And so when we talk about medical marijuana, maybe eventually we won't just speak about it in one big broad category. We'll start to speak more specifically about it. Is that possible, Nancy?
Yeah, and I believe the growers are mandated to offer three different options in terms of the level of THC. One's like a 50-50 and so forth. So, again, lots of unknowns.
Okay, I want to get to Dave's comments here. You know, he thinks there's a bit of a, it sounds like Dave thinks there's a Trojan horse aspect of this, that this is really about full legalization. Here's Dave's comments. I won't paraphrase. He says, this is way too complicated. What's wrong with the Colorado model? It works. It's tax lucrative. Also, medical marijuana isn't really about medical. It's about marijuana. The medical is just a pretense towards legalization. So legalize. Stop playing around with complicated framework. Or not, but this is a silly sideshow as opposed to the Colorado and Washington approach. And that, but you kind of shook your head, Veronica, and we're not weighing in with an opinion here. I know some people think that this is on the road to legalization. Some people do want full legalization, some don't. But I've spoken to enough people professionally in the medical world to at least say this isn't just about legalization.
I've also spoken to enough patients to know that it's not about legalization.
Right,
at the end
right.
of the day, this is a treatment option for people who have run out of options. And I think about, you know, some of the parents that I've interviewed who have children with epilepsy who can't get it under control with, classic medicine. And they're hoping that this will be like an answer to their prayers. I don't look at those people and think, oh, you just want to get high. You're looking for a path to legalization. I would say that that's not necessarily true.
All right, Nancy?
No, I agree. The focus needs to remain on these patients that, rightly so, have run out of options. And I think the legalization of marijuana issue, really, that's something we have to put aside until we get this figured out.
Dr. Valenti?
And it's just difficult at times to get out from under that shadow of a recreational drug being used as a treatment. And I agree we need to sort it out and continue to focus on the patient.
Can I be really ignorant for a second? I mean, that's like pretty much all the time. But can I be really, really ignorant here? Going from Bill's right here. When something is a quote-unquote recreational drug, it's got a bit of a stigma. So there's a slower acceptance that maybe it's a viable medical option, et cetera. So here's where my ignorance comes in. But, you know, many substances can be abused, right? I mean, you can recreationally abuse very many things, and people do. And do we overly focus on on marijuana's sort of status as a recreational drug, as opposed to saying, okay, it's a recreational drug, but let's just try to focus on its medicinal aspects. Let's treat it like that. Let's not let that stigma determine what how we're going to guide medical treatment, because unfortunately, oxycodone is abused recreationally. I could pick up any number of things.
Alcohol.
There you go. But alcohol
is not a drug.
But you could pick drugs that were not recreational first that become recreational, and it goes both ways. And do we get overly careful because of its status? Bill?
Yes, and that's where clinical research and research trials can help us sort this out. As with any kind of category of drugs, over time, we learn more about the drugs and how they work. And also, when you manufacture them year after year after year, they get cleaner and better. So I expect that we'll continue to learn. Good place to start some clinical research.
Okay, Nancy?
Yeah, I think that there will be physicians who, have this stigma attached to medical marijuana. But I think definitely the more research and data that we can provide the physicians, the more comfortable they'll be. And at the end of the day, there may be some who just say, no, this is not something that, I want to get involved with for my patients, and they will need to, go elsewhere if that's a path they want.
And they have
take.
That option.
That's right.
Absolutely. So we've got a few more minutes left with our panel here for the hour. You're hearing Nancy Adams, Executive Director of the Monroe County Medical Society, Dr. William Valenti, a co-founder and staff physician at Trillium Health, Veronica Volk, WXXI reporter in studio with us as well here. And Veronica, on price guidelines, we talked about cost, et cetera. Price guidelines coming from the New York State Department of Health?
Yes. Apparently, they have set guidelines, but those are obviously flexible depending on what the company charges. But they're also kind of mostly available to the company itself. patient can't set their own prices, is what I'm trying to say.
And there are waivers for patients who can show an economic hardship. They can get the waiver through the Department of Health.
Okay, so...
And there are also other cost barriers. Patients have to pay, I think it's a $50 a year fee to hold on to their medical marijuana card. Obviously, we talked about the cost for doctors. They have to pay $250 to take that four-hour course. You know, there's just a lot of different costs.
Okay, but though it is not covered by insurance and doesn't appear that it would be anytime soon, Nancy, you're saying the economic hardship, you can get a waiver.
You can, but I believe there's pretty strict criteria to qualify. But yes, waivers are available, including for that $50 fee to hold your card.
How would you find out if you're eligible?
Through the Department of Health. Everything's right up on the website. There's the forms to fill out and so forth.
All right. Okay. David writes to us and says, you know, I understand the desire not to overstate the impact of medical marijuana, and I agree it needs more study. But isn't it true that at least when it comes to mitigating pain and other things, we have already seen evidence start to pile up? That's from David. I don't know. Dr. Valenti, you had referenced some study earlier this hour. What do you know about what the evidence does say?
Right. For nerve pain, for example, been shown there's evidence to support treatment in nerve pain. Some of the situations that occur in multiple sclerosis are a part of that. And as an appetite stimulant, also effective. In other areas, the evidence is what we would call soft. So again, the call for more research on the different components, cannabinoids, that may work in certain situations. Big learning curve.
But it does sound, I mean, we're talking nerve pain. I mean, there's a lot of people we're talking about with pain, you know. So I don't want to David's point, the emailer, I understand his point, but I don't want to minimize the people who may be suffering from pain, who might have a potential benefit here.
And I think that's the focal point here is wanting to do right by the patient. And because this is a little different, it's going to take a little bit longer. I think we've pointed out that it's a little more complex than just writing a prescription. But at the end of the day, it's about the patient.
Okay, well, before we lose the hour, let me ask our panelists then what the biggest questions going forward are. And Veronica, you've been reporting on this, and you continue to report on this. In fact, during the hour in real time, you've been hearing from people.
What a
in the
wonderful
industry.
World we live on. Yeah, actually, I just got an email telling me that the Rochester dispensary is scheduled to be open on Thursday, January 28th. They're going to have a media preview, so obviously I'll be there on behalf of WXXI. So listeners can, you know, follow my coverage on our website, WXXINews.org.
Thursday, January 28th. That's a week
There's
from
a
today,
ribbon
right?
cutting ceremony at 11 o'clock.
All right. So 1 week from today, the Rochester Dispensary will be open. Eastman Business Park.
Yes.
Okay. Breaking news on the show.
I know. This is great.
And that's not a surprise, as Nancy said, even though we didn't know until now.
Well, no, but it is good news for people who weren't sure, you know, when this was going to happen.
Okay. Nancy, what are the big questions that you want answered going forward?
You know, I think the biggest thing, and I'm looking at this from the physician's perspective, is it just in terms of getting the you know, the treatment related questions answered. So the side effects, the drug interactions, the dosing questions, those are the questions that really need to be answered in order for this program to be successful.
Dr. Valenti,
I'd like to know more about where this fits with other opiate drugs, other narcotic drugs, because it's a huge problem with abuse of those drugs, overuse of those drugs. And I wonder if cannabis could be a substitute and help with that the opioid problem. So more to learn.
Okay. When it comes to the other states, by the way, we raised the question, well, a caller, Peggy, raised the question on what are they going to do with the marijuana if this thing is kind of a flop? And as Veronica, you mentioned, the people in charge of that part of the program are essentially saying, we're assuming it's not going to be a flop. We don't have a backup plan for that, but we don't have reason to think it will flop based on other states, I don't think. Even though the other states allow it to be smoked and it's different state to state, how it's administered, et cetera.
Well, yeah, and I think a good way of maybe gauging that is just by looking at the number of doctors and patients who've signed up In recent weeks, I have some numbers here. It's over 200 doctors are now registered. And
statewide?
Yes, statewide. And over 200 patients. Last week, it was 166 patients. So we know that more people are signing up. Doesn't say a whole lot because there are something like 80,000 physicians in New York State and possibly as many as 500,000 patients who have qualifying conditions. So the numbers are comparatively small, but they are growing.
But this rollout hasn't come with billboards on every highway and, to my knowledge, not a big public information campaign,
right,
which is probably fine. It's probably designed to be low and slow, as we've been saying. So I'm not surprised by those numbers. And maybe we'll continue to follow it. But, Nancy, would you be surprised if this was a flop enough to where a year or 5 years from now medical cannabis doesn't even exist in the state anymore?
Yeah, I would be surprised if it was a flop. I think it's a bit of a slow go here, the first, you know, year at least, but I can't imagine, given the experience in the other states, that it would totally flop.
Yeah, and I'm not missing anything on a public information campaign, right? I mean, I imagine that has been sort of by design. Though there is a website. I jumped online, the website on the New York Compassionate Care Act. If you just Google New York State Compassionate Care Act, it just kind of gives you some basics.
Right. And of course, as Nancy said, you can always go to the State Department of Health website, too. There's a lot of information on there.
It's actually very well done. There's a section for patients. Mm-hmm. There's a section for physicians. I highly recommend that site.
Bill, would you be surprised if this flops enough that we don't see it anymore?
Right. I think it'll work. It's going to take time for all the pieces to come together, but it'll work. It'll be a therapeutic alternative.
Well, we not only answered a lot of listener and our questions this hour, but we broke a little news. Veronica Volk reporting this hour, by the minute,
yes,
that 1 week from today, what's the name of the dispensary? Is it just the Rochester dispensary? Or is
no,
it?
It's a Columbia Care.
Oh, I'm sorry, Columbia, yes. Care. Columbia Care is going, brand it, please. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're at least you're going to mention it. Columbia Care's dispensary opens 1 week from today. I'm sure we'll be reporting on that.
Absolutely.
Thank you for the great work and helping put together this hour, answering a lot of questions. Veronica Volk, WXXI reporter.
Thanks so much for having me.
Nancy Adams, the Executive Director of the Monroe County Medical Society. Always great to have you, Nancy.
Right, thank you so much.
And Dr. Bill Valenti, the co-founder and staff physician at Trillium Health. Dr. Valenti, always a pleasure. Thank you, sir.
Mm-hmm, thanks.
And thanks for listening to our 2 hours today. A little sunshine at the end of our day. Though I suspect wherever people are listening to this saying, not where I am, that's always the danger. I hope you've had a great afternoon. Our thanks to the engineer of this program, Valerie LaBanca. Megan Mack is the producer of Connections. Thanks to our interns this semester, Kate Cowie-Haskell and Marielle Brinkerhoff. I'm your host, Evan Dawson. Thanks to Barsuk Records for the music for this program and to you for listening. We'll talk to you Friday on member-supported public radio.